Well, now to what could be read as a feminist tale set over 300 years ago. Our guest is the best-selling Australian historical novelist Lauren Chater, who's brought to life in her new book, Gulliver's Wife, the experiences of 18th century women whose husbands were prone to taking off on years-long fantastic journeys overseas, as was the case with Mary Burton Gulliver, midwife, herbalist, and the long-suffering spouse of Lemuel Gulliver, the hero of Jonathan Swift's classic Gulliver's Travels. In Lauren's version, Gulliver is presumed dead, but returns full of tales being tied down by little people in Lilliput. Worse, his reappearance threatens Mary's newfound independence. Here, Lauren Chater has written a fiction based on fiction as a vehicle to explore the more often than not sorry lot of the women who got left behind. Lauren Chater is also the author of the best-selling historical novel, The Lace Weaver, and she shares biscuit recipes on The Well-Read Cookie, where her love of baking and literature come together. Lauren, welcome to 9 to Noon. Thanks very much for waiting for us.
Thanks, Catherine.
Let's start at the end of your new book, where you very usefully have an author's note given context to Swift's story. Remind us of what happens in Gulliver's Travels, but also what Swift intended in writing it.
So Gulliver's Travels was originally published in 1726. It was written by Jonathan Swift, who was an Irish English playwright and a writer. And he actually intended Gulliver's Travels to be a parody, a satire, and it was about the English politics of the time. It was sort of taking the mickey out of Queen Anne and her and the way that the English colonised little islands. So not so subtle, because he published it anonymously. He knew he would get into trouble because he was being a bit naughty. But it tells the story of Lemuel Gulliver, who was a sailor surgeon, and he goes out to sea and has these sort of fantastic adventures, and then comes home and talks in sort of riddles and tells people all about these amazing things that he's seen. And by the end of the story, he's gone a little bit mad. He's sort of a bit sick of society, and he prefers the company of his horses to that of his family and his wife. So it's commentary on English civilization and how perhaps they weren't as civilized as they thought they were.
The most memorable creation, of course, the Lilliputians, these tiny...
That's right.
these tiny people who kept Big Gulliver captured. I mean, even Gulliver's own name is a nod towards the satirical bent, isn't it? We think of the word gullible, and that's exactly what it was referring to.
Yes, it was to gull someone meant to pull the wool over their eyes.
So you take on an interesting challenge here, because first is... in many ways, taking on the language and the characters, of course, of one of the great writers, certainly one of the most famous and most read and memorable books. How did you put yourself into the author's perspective first, and then into his characters? What was involved?
Well, it was quite a challenge. I mean, I think it takes risk to write a book, and it takes guts and a bit of courage, but particularly to write characters that are so well known and also well loved. You know, lots of people love Gulliver, and lots of people even think that Gulliver is a real person. I didn't realise until I started researching and started talking about it, and people are like, oh yeah, I've read that book about Gulliver and I know about him. And I thought, but he's a fictional character. So it's amazing how his Swift story has managed to permeate our imagination, and that we truly believe that Gulliver is a real person. So I just went into it thinking that I have to sort of preserve the sanctity of that story. But then once I started writing it, I had to let go of all that, because it's not the story of Lemuel Gulliver. It's the story of his wife. And I had to think about Mary's perspective and how she would have responded to this idea of her husband coming home after being presumed dead and speaking in riddles and possibly being mad.
We are seeing a trend of the reimagining of the classics, and sometimes picking a lesser character or a minor character, if I can use those words in little finger quotes, right? Someone who in the original novel was a side character but is drawn out and given their own life. We've seen a number of examples of this, particularly with some of the great classics. And for you, was there an appeal in taking on that as a challenge? What was the prompt for this?
So a few years ago, I was working in my local library And I was shelving the books, and I thought I would set myself a challenge and I would try to read all the books in the section titled 1001 Books to Read Before You Die. It was a very ambitious project and not sure that it was entirely successful because I think I only got up to about ST. But one of the great things to come out of it was that I reread Gulliver's Travels as an adult. And it's been very commonly bolderized, which means that it's commonly reprinted as a story for children, but actually Swift had intended it to be read by adults. And so when I was rereading it, I kept coming across these little hints about Mary Burton, who is Gulliver's wife. She is the daughter of a hosier, and there's not a huge amount of information about her. Gulliver really only thinks of her when he comes home, and she's the sort of thing that anchors him to English society. And so that was the real prompt for me, that I wanted to explore those hidden stories. And I think I was reading at the time Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls and also Madeline Miller's Circe, and I loved those books, and I thought, there's a story in here.
The research involved, obviously reading itself is an important part of it, and reading the literature of the time, the original literature, but what else did you do to take yourself back to where Gulliver's Wife begins, 1702?
1702, such a brutal time to be alive.
It was, just remind people what was going on.
Oh, so obviously infant mortality rates and the rates of women dying in childbirth were horrendously high during that time period. People could be jailed for the smallest of crimes. Crime was a huge. People loved to steal because they were starving. They had to steal their food. They had to steal clothing to keep themselves warm. The winters were freezing. It was a lot colder back then than it is now, obviously with global warming. And so so it was just not a very nice time to be alive. We think about now we're waiting for this amazing vaccine during the pandemic. These people had plague every year and they had no idea how to fight it and they had no idea what it really was. And so it was very difficult for them to get through. And yet somehow they survived and they had hope. And so that was something that I really wanted to get across in the story, that even though Mary is living through these terrible times with her daughter, that they try to help the women around them to give birth and to care for each other. Because I think that would have been really important, looking after your neighbours, just as it is now.
The mortality rates, the infant mortality rates were dreadful. And this is not just in itself an awful experience. It leads into the mental well-being of the characters in a way that was probably not considered or explored at the time. We have a focus on mental health now. We understand very deeply how profound and long-lived the loss of an infant is, or of a miscarriage, but back in the day, how did society deal with women going through this, and how did women deal with it?
Yeah, they were sort of expected to just get on with it, and they did have a lot of children. Women generally did give birth quite often because there was obviously no contraception, or people didn't really use it if there was, Yeah, the poor women, they just had to get on with things as best they could. But obviously they held that trauma and that sadness within them. And there was this perception that people didn't care about their children back then, that by academics, that people just had more children and then they moved on. But I think when you read a lot of the literature of the times and you read the diaries, even Samuel Pepys, when you read his diaries and you read about the people, the friends that have lost children, they mourned those children, and mourning was a huge part of society, even perhaps more so than now. Funerals were a massive deal and people got invitations to funerals. And so people did go through that process of mourning for their infants and the children that they'd lost, but they just weren't allowed to show it after the funeral had taken place, really.
So Mary Gulliver and midwifery itself actually forms part of this narrative. What was the role and how prominent was the role of the midwives at this time?
The midwives were an incredible institution during this time. They were very well respected in London. They had their own training system and they had apprentices and they had women who would become deputies. So there was a very tiered training system where you had to spend at least 7 or 8 years in order to become a full midwife. You also had to swear an oath, a midwife's oath, and that was sanctified by the church. So they they were really in control of the midwifery group at that time, making sure that women could baptize babies because they didn't want to lose them to the sort of Catholic flock at the time. And so the Protestant bishops made sure that they sort of kept the midwives in line. But the midwives had their own they had their own system, and they had their own kind of independence. So they were allowed to move around the streets where perhaps other women of that stature might not have been able to go. And they used to wear these incredible red capes, which was almost a beacon. So when you saw the red cape coming, you would know that help was on its way.
There was a power struggle, was there not, between the barber surgeons as midwives and midwives at the heart of Gulliver's Wife. Could you elaborate a little for us?
Yeah. So during that time, the midwives came up against one of their greatest challenges, which was the forceps. A family called the Chamberlains had invented these iron clamps. They called them the forceps, and they were kept a secret for 150 years. But then, the Chamberlains decided that they needed money. So they sell the patent for the forceps. And this suddenly turned the midwives' worlds upside down, because barber surgeons had not been allowed into the birthing chamber until that moment. But now, unless there was an emergency, and then they would be called. And usually it was because there was going to be a fatality, and they had to women weren't allowed to see that kind of thing because supposedly they weren't equipped to deal with that sort of trauma, which we know is obviously not true. But the barber surgeons were called in more commonly now to use those forceps. And so the midwives found themselves fighting for control and to look after the women in their care, because they weren't against the forceps per se, but they wanted people to be trained in using them. And of course, the fact that women were not allowed to use surgical instruments meant that midwives would become redundant, and their care, they wouldn't be allowed to practice. So they were very forcefully fighting the use of these forceps at that time.
So there is some more politics. Let's get to the personal politics now as well, the family politics. Lauren Chait is our guest. We're talking about her new novel, Gulliver's Wife. You're listening to 9 to Noon. It's 29 minutes past 10. So of Lemuel Gulliver and Mary, how do you portray their relationship through her eyes? How do you see him and portray him? And then let's focus more on Mary's experience after that. But do you judge him?
As an author, I don't judge him. But when I'm in character and I'm in Mary's character, I think Mary does have some issues with Gulliver. He's kind of the everyman of that time period, though, as well, because he's a teller of tales, and men. It was just assumed that they knew more than women, and that they were equipped to be able to handle things better. And so Gulliver he's a man, a great man. His daughter Bess calls him the great man, and he's always at sea. So he's travelled, and travel imbues him with this sense of importance. But for Mary, she's always stayed in London. And so I wanted to portray Gulliver as being this person in Mary's life who seems to have all the answers, and she very quickly realises after they marry that in fact he's not the person that he appears to be, and he's just as fallible as everybody else, and perhaps gullible, even more gullible than she is.
In Gulliver's Travels, I think she's barely mentioned, isn't she, in Swift's,
that's right.
Swift's book maybe half a dozen times, so that might be a clue. And, of course, they are representative, of others of the day? As you say, it was every man. The idea that for the woman it was home and hearth, and for the men it was the adventuring.
That's right. And so women were left behind. Nobody really worried about what they would be going through, because it was just expected that they would be there when the man got home, and that things would just resume without any kind of transitional period or any kind of sort of greeting that for the poor women, they would have to suddenly scramble to get together all their things that the men required of them, the food that they liked and the drinks that they liked. And so the poor women left behind, having to suddenly adjust to having a man home after 3 years of independence and freedom, especially in Mary's case. Mary is considered a widow because Gulliver has been lost at sea. So to have that widowhood snatched away from her, I tried to portray accurately how that might feel for someone of like Mary, who thinks and has a brain and suddenly is confronted by this fact that they're subjugated again to their husband's whims.
So she's faced with this. She's moved on, so to speak. She is building her own life. She's not expecting her husband back. And so we get to the realities of what happens when he is back. And again, you're having to put, like, we could make our own contemporary, form our own contemporary views on how this would play out now. But you are constantly having to put yourself back in your character and back in the day. Did you play around with a few different scenes, a few different ways that things may have gone here? Or did she speak very strongly through your writing hand?
I did play around with a few different ideas. I think in the initial drafts I made Gulliver a lot more likeable, but it didn't really suit kind of the themes of the story, which really essentially are about small lives and big lives, who gets to say who has the big important role in society, and where all these women are actually doing this amazing work behind the scenes, and they are equally as important and their adventures equally as fascinating as those of the male adventurers. So I did have to do a bit of work in understanding Mary, and I think that's probably where a lot of authors find that they have to do most of their work, is understanding their character and making them fit within the timeframes. So for women, there was really no option of divorce. So poor Mary, she would have been stuck with Gulliver, which she is at the end of the novel, not to give too much away, but I think it's not a spoiler because it's in the original Gulliver's Travels. But there was no option for that. There was for divorce for rich women, but then often the man would take the children away and any of the woman's inheritance. So for Mary, it's really not an option. But I came to love Mary. I think there's a lot of me in her, and she thinks she's 38, which is the same age that I am, and she has children, and she has to balance her professional work with her domestic duties, which I think a lot of women these days could really identify with, that push and pull, needing to be in one place and then keep an eye on your children, especially now that they're being homeschooled. And making sure that they're not running amok like Bess is out on the streets.
How does that go for novel writing, by the way, having the kids on?
it's very, yeah, very difficult at the moment. I've escaped to my friend's granny flat, so that's nice.
As you pointed out, the mother-daughter relationship going on here as well. The daughter, Bess, loves her father, even though he is absent. And so how does that complicate also Mary's own position?
Yeah, so Bess thinks that her father is this wonderful, incredible person, infallible, and Bess is 14. So when her father left for sea, she was only 11, and she didn't really have any idea of what his true nature was, because 11-year-olds don't really, you know, we don't really understand what our parents are like at that age. And Bess has been protected a lot by Mary. So Gulliver has always been telling Bess tales, and he's always promised her that she will go to sea with him. So she's been brought up imagining that one day she and Gulliver will run off to sea together, and she will help him as a ship's assistant, surgeon's assistant. But as the story goes on and Gulliver returns, Bess is at first elated and then has to come to terms with the fact that her father is actually human and very fallible. And I think it's like a lot of sort of coming of age or transformation stories. It's what we always knew was there, but it's coming to that understanding, and it can be quite painful at times. So Bess comes to see her mother, actually, is this person that she hadn't expected her to be, and does this incredible work in the community. And her mother is actually the big figure rather than her father, as she originally thought.
The other underlying theme here is why people married at all in those days, and was there any alternative? Because one gets the sense from Mary she could easily have not married Gulliver. There was no great passion, it appears, in their marriage, or the coming together of their marriage anyway. But was it a reality for women of the times that you were, you know, either forced, or that the economic circumstances determined you marry?
Yeah, it was certainly expected that women during that time married. Women didn't want to be a burden on their families. And as aging parents were unable to work, the duty of care would fall on women. And women's ability to work was extremely limited already. There weren't many trades that women could do. They couldn't join guilds. They weren't allowed. And so really there weren't many options employment-wise. They would have been allowed to become perhaps grocers. They would have been able to have a cart, but that wouldn't have made them much money. And so for Mary, she really has to choose between whether she wants to stay with her father, because her mother's passed away, and endure that kind of hardship and put him through that poverty, or whether she will marry Gulliver, who offers her this safety net and possible elevation of status and reputation as well, because he's somewhat of a gentleman and he comes from some money in the country.
You have your next book underway already, just listening to the challenges of working from home, and especially in such a creative endeavour as writing novels. What has caught your attention as the setting and the time for this forthcoming work?
So the next novel is called The Winter Dress. It's set in the present day, although it may now be 2018, the distant past, without having to deal with the pandemic reality. But it's also set in the 17th century, and it's set in Australia and Holland. It's inspired by a 17th century Dutch dress, this beautiful silk dress that was brought up in 2014 by some amateur divers off the coast of Texel, which is in Holland, in North Holland. These divers, they're sort of treasure hunters. This is true. They're treasure hunters, and they dive down and explore these ships, and they brought up this incredible gown, and they didn't know what it was. So they hosed it down, and they hung it in their bathroom, and then it was discovered at a barbecue by a curator of the local museum, and she said that is a 17th century dress. And so then of course it went to the Rijksmuseum, and it's being studied, but for me the interest of the story is the dress's origins. And so my story is about a textiles historian who's been living in Australia after leaving Texel as a child, and she's pulled back home by the dress and the discovery of the dress, and she has to unravel the mystery of who wore it. And it's also in the 17th century the story of Anna Schumann, who is a glass engraver, and has to flee her home and takes refuge at the court of the Winter Queen, Elizabeth Stuart. She's called the Winter Queen because she only reigned for one season with her husband. And so it's a story about women's craft making and exile and grief and loss. And that's as far as I've got with it.
The craft and the baking are absolutely intertwined in your life and even in your literature. Tell me about the Roald Dahl biscuit, the fantastic Mr. Fox.
it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's kind of kitschy and cute, but I it's brought me a lot of joy doing it. I took it up after my daughter was born, and as if I wasn't busy enough, I thought I would teach myself something new. And so I was running in between feeds, making these cookies and teaching myself how to ice them. It was a way to connect with readers at the time and other people who loved books, and I would ask them for their ideas, what should I make next, and then it would become a conversation. But I just became addicted to it. I have over 300 cookie cutters spilling out of the cupboards, and
Pride and Prejudice and zombie biscuits. Yes, zombies. Do they come from the same roots? Do they come from the joys and the comforts of childhood, do you think? The reading and the baking, and can you see a thread?
Yeah, I think that definitely they do. And it's also just kind of fun, and it's a way of enjoying literature in another sense and prolonging that enjoyment and saying, hey, remember this book. I've made this cookie based on it, and people love it. And then it's gone as well. There's this idea of it's just so fleeting, because then you've eaten the cookie and there's nothing left. photographing them is a nice way of preserving the longevity of that idea.
Thank you, Lauren. Lauren Chater, the author of the best-selling historical novel, The Lace Weaver, and the later work that we have just been discussing, Gulliver's Wife.